Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University.
Welcome back. I am here today with Chris McDonald. And Chris McDonald is not only a longtime friend, but he's also a wildlife professional and a deer management guru. Chris is he's a wildlife biologist. And Chris, you worked for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks for how many years? So I'm going to kind of turn it over to you now and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you garnered all this deer management expertise, and we'll kind of go from there.
All right, sounds good, Bronson. Thank you for having me today. Just glad to be able just to sit around and talk about deer for several minutes. Just one of my passions. I grew up in Mississippi, born and bred, and been managing deer as long as I can remember. Grew up on a family farm in Winona, and been an avid hunter. I guess been hunting since I was probably 6-7 years of age, and really got turned on to deer hunting with my dad, and just went from there. And now I think I enjoy managing deer more than I enjoy hunting now, but I love both of them. But like you said, I am a wildlife biologist. I started out my career with Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks back in 2003. Started with them as a regional biologist in southwest Mississippi, and that kind of turned into a program-specific biologist, spending 100% of my time working with landowners regarding deer management and hunting clubs, and just very fortunate to spend all my time managing deer back then, and got to work with a lot of great people at that agency. I have a lot of family and friends still there, but now I'm working with the Timberland Agency. We provide pretty much any type of land management services that anybody would need, from timber management to habitat management, population management, to some real estate services as well. So just very fortunate to work in Mississippi and other states, just trying to teach people how to manage deer and look at their successes.
So it's a one-stop shop. Is that right, Chris? Not only
Yes. The
deer management expertise, but habitat management, timber management, y'all kind of do it all.
Yes, we can pretty much provide anyone with anything that they need from a land perspective. And one really good thing about, what I can do now is when I was with the wildlife agency, I would make recommendations to people regarding habitat, and it'd be kind of up to them to find some private professional to come in and actually apply those recommendations and improve that habitat. Well, now I can, look to my partner that he can be in a truck at the same time with me, and we're talking to the landowner, and we can make a recommendation today and be on the ground tomorrow implementing that recommendation and improve that habitat based on management goals of that landowner.
Well, Chris, one thing, we are, at least in the South and in Mississippi, we're right in the heart of deer season right now. And so we are at that time of year when maybe not habitat decisions, but harvest decisions are being made. And one thing I wanted to touch base with you on is success stories. And so you've worked with, I don't know how many hunting clubs. You may want to tell us how many different hunting clubs you've worked with in the past, properties, private landowners, et cetera, and you've helped them hopefully fulfill their deer management objectives. And if there's a way you could maybe generalize for us, Chris, you know, I'm kind of thinking of a top three list of, you know, when you reflect back on this property and that property and they were successful, what kind of things did they have in common? What things did they do right? So when you look back and say, that's the reason they've been successful, and for an opposing view, I want to ask you after that, these hunting clubs that aren't successful, what are they doing wrong? And I hope this provides our listeners with a lot of information that they can think about and implement over the 2017 and 18 deer season.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. Fortunately, throughout my career, I've been able to work with probably in excess of 200 properties or so just from a wildlife management standpoint. And at the peak, I had probably about 120 DMAP clubs or more, Deer Management Assistance Program, you know, working with them, primarily looking at harvest data and aging jawbones and a little bit population management. But, you know, fortunately, throughout the years, got to see a lot of different clubs, different properties, and like you said, some are better than others on what they can actually do from a management standpoint. I guess one of the most important aspects of a successful property is actually having control of the land, having control of the habitat. You get into a situation with leases where the club or the people hunting it, they don't control the land. So, you know, they're at the mercy of the landowner. So if those goals are different between the hunting club and the landowner, you're going to have some issues there with success. So I think number one is, you know, having control or having an owner that will allow you to manipulate the habitat based on wildlife management goals. And two is having the right people in place, whether it's being a hunting club or just a private property that just friends and family are hunting, but now having the people on the same page. Because if you got different management goals and management philosophies within a group, it's going to be a lot of conflict there, and it's going to be hard to meet your management goals. So having a good group of people sharing the same management goals, having means to manipulate habitat on the property. And, you know, if you're a diehard deer person, you need to be in a good location. Depending on what your goals are, you know, if your goal is to see a lot of deer and have a really good, healthy deer herd and optimize that deer herd, you want to be on some of the higher fertile soils in the state compared to, you know, some of the soils with less soil fertility and poor habitat. So location is a key to meet management goals, depending on what those goals are.
So let me back up on something you said, Chris. Controlling the habitat, and so a prerequisite for that is you either need to be the owner of the land or you have permission from the owner of the land. Tell me, and I fully understand that, because when you can manage the habitat, now you can manage the deer herd and you can manage the habitat. That's the best possible situation. But there are so many people that don't own property or property large enough to manage a deer herd. Have you seen success with people that may lease land? They may lease 500 acres or 5,000 acres, and really can't get into habitat management. So really their management is from the population side, and mm-hmm. then what we would say is supplementing or augmenting food in the form of food plots or something like that. if you could paint with a broad brush, can those people be just as successive, or are you just kind of saying that on the average, they can never reach quite the success of someone that owns the property?
Yeah, and like I said earlier, not actually, you don't have to necessarily own the property, but having at least an owner that is willing to work with you to manage habitat. If your goal is to maximize the quality and health of a deer herd or, any wildlife in general, you've got to be able to manage the habitat. So I'd say if you're limited, most people in Mississippi are limited because they do lease the property. It's just the way the world works. So you're probably going to be at 75% to 80%. Maybe on what you can do on a property from a deer population standpoint. And one of the easiest things you can do if you can get the people on board is just get the deer to an older age if you're wanting to grow larger bucks. And so anybody can do that as long as you get cooperation from your hunters. So,
I completely agree, Chris. I don't like to discourage people. I think there's always a situation where management can be used to improve the situation. A scenario may be, hey, we only lease 300 acres. Well, let's be realistic. If you lease 300 acres, number one, you're probably not going to be able to manage the habitat, and number two, you're really not managing the deer herd, a buck's home range, depending on time of year, where you're at, et cetera, is going to be anywhere, from 1,000 acres to 2,000 acres. So you really have to have sufficient land that completely, encapsulate, but, you have to have deer home ranges on your property exclusively, and that's when you really get into managing a deer herd per se. But that does not mean that on your 300 acres you can improve what you have, and a lot of times that might be with food plots, and that doesn't mean that you can't improve your deer hunting, meaning that if you improve your habitat relative to the surrounding property, deer will want to spend more time on your property, and that can either facilitate harvest on your property, or that may give you the opportunity to pass on bucks that show promise later in life.
And, in the real world that I'm in, everybody is not fortunate to be able to own, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 acres to really impact a deer herd at the population level. But they can talk with their neighbors. If you have 300 acres and I've got 300 acres and our other neighbors have 500 here, or 200 there. We can try to get on the same page, and if everybody's kind of looking at the same management goal, we can put those different pieces of property into the same management program. Like I said, though, the key is everyone on the same page?
Yeah.
If you got five different properties and they have five different management goals, you're not going to be real successful. But if they're, everybody's kind of on the same page, you can do some good things on smaller acreages. This weekend, I saw a buck harvested on, I think the gentleman had 540 acres. And that deer looked like he's going to be, in 180-inch range, 180-inch class deer on 500 acres. So you don't have to have 500 or 5,000 acres to manage wildlife. You just got to be able to have a good, sound management goal and be willing to put the effort in. And hopefully, if you need some more acreage, talk to your neighbors, see if they'll get on the same page with you.
Yeah, what a great reason to get together and share some venison, cook some venison together. Everybody pull out those trail camera photos, and let's all agree that this is a buck that's on our list. We want to watch him, and let's all agree to pass him this year, and let's see what he does next year. And had a great little success story about 2 days ago, Chris. Someone sent me a photo and said, so glad we didn't harvest him last year. And this year he is just spectacular. You know, one of those bucks that anybody would be proud of. And fully mature, you know, before the deer season. I mean, he kind of took that last step in terms of body development and antler development. And, yeah, I was just happy for him. Congratulations. And that's management. You said a moment ago the world we live in. Well, the world we do live in, too, is people want to see things immediately, immediate results. And when you're managing deer, you can't think of deer management on a daily scale or weekly scale. It's an annual scale. And it literally takes years to turn things around. And I think that's why one reason a lot of people lose momentum. They can work hard 1 year, and if they don't see the results the next year, they're like, this stuff isn't working or whatever. But it really is. You really need about a 2 to 3 year commitment to really start turning that population around.
If I take a new property on, or you know, somebody just looking for information and some help, I tell them I need at least a 3 year commitment from them from a deer management standpoint, just to start about that. That third hunting season, that's when you start really seeing some progress. And, you know, if they're not willing to make that commitment, it's, you know, unfortunately, as professionals, it's not a whole lot we can do for them.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right.
And one thing I do want to reiterate, or, you know, we're talking about management and doing this and doing that and whatever. But the main thing is make sure you're having fun doing it. If it gets to a point where you're not having fun, and that's going to make you not go in the woods, you're going too far. You know, not everybody has to be, you know, have a goal of optimizing antler size. Your goal may just be to see some, you know, nice 2 to 3 year old bucks and harvest a few does a year and just get the kids out in the woods with you and just have a, you know, a good family atmosphere. So just make sure you're having fun doing whatever you're doing.
That's exactly right. If you're not having fun, you know, we always joke, Chris, that it's therapy. Getting out in the woods is therapy. And, you know, the harvest or the kill, that's fantastic when it happens. But that's exactly right. If you're not having fun, then what use is it? Yeah,
yep.
I couldn't agree more. So, Chris, tell me, so let's go with this optimal scenario where we have sufficient acreage for the property, or we have a cooperative of properties where, you know, we might be getting into the 500 to well over 1,000 acres. And let's say they have the opportunity to manage the habitat. What would be your most common habitat prescription? I have a pretty good guess of what it is, but I want to hear it from you. What typically is the first thing that you would say that, number one, habitat, you need to do this?
You have to have a very strong timber management plan for the property.
Okay, why is that?
That is, I mean, that's your habitat. For most properties, you're looking at a large percentage of that property is going to be forested. And, you know, if you're dealing with a closed canopy habitat with little vegetation on the ground or little preferred vegetation on the ground for deer, you know, you're not going to be able to optimize that property and optimize the health of that deer herd. That's one of the biggest problems I've seen throughout the past. And this comes with, with leased properties, you know, that's where you do not have control of the timber management on a leased property. So you're just at the mercy of whatever the landowner's willing to do. But there's only so much that as a biologist that I can do for a piece of property, you know, just at the population level and with food plots. If you're really wanting to optimize that deer herd and meet your overall goals and objectives, you've got to have a sound timber management program.
You know what deer eat, Chris? They eat plants.
They do.
They eat herbaceous plants that we call forbs, but basically deer eat broad-leafed plants.
Yep.
And another way I like to explain it to people is kind of the other way around it is we're managing timber, but really or ultimately what we're doing is we're managing sunlight.
Managing sunlight in that plant community.
In a perfect world, I would love to have 50% of a property where sunlight is shining directly on herbaceous plants.
Mm-hmm.
And man, you are kicking it into high gear then in terms of food production.
And most people, you're talking about timber production, timber management, and most hunters anyway, are going to think about acorn production. Well, you know, most people want to protect all the oaks, protect all the hard mass producers, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got to harvest timber just like you have to harvest deer. You can not harvest deer and you're going to be, you know, you're going to go the opposite direction of what your management goal is. In the same way with timber. If you're not actively harvesting timber, you're not improving the habitat, i.e. you're not improving that plant community for that deer herd. And our focus may be on deer, but we're going to make this habitat beneficial for other species, especially turkeys, other songbirds. You're going to affect other walleye species when you're doing this, just not the deer herd.
Yeah, and you're going to affect most of them positively, without a doubt.
Provide nesting habitat, brood habitat, cover. I've got one property I'm working with right now that, you know, they're that typical property that they've always been scared to actively manage their timber. And it's a lot of it's just closed canopy, you know, 30 to 40-year-old trees on it. It looks pretty, just aesthetically pleasing, but they're wondering why they don't have that many deer on their property. Well, the plant community under those trees are mostly shade tolerant, low preferred deer plants. They've
right.
got a little bit of cover, but that's pretty much it. It's very little walleye benefit to with that understory. So I'm trying to change their mentality, just kind of like some of the older hunters may be concerned about shooting or harvesting does. You know, they grew up in that era that does are sacred and you don't need to shoot them. Well, same thing with timber management. A lot of people grew up that you don't cut an oak down. Well,
right.
You
right.
got to harvest does, and you've got to harvest timber to create habitat.
The sacred doe and the sacred oak.
Yeah.
It's this very similar principle, and you know, in my neck of the woods where I'm at, more of East Mississippi relative to where you're at. You're in more western and even southwestern Mississippi, but over here, most forests are composed primarily of pine trees. You know, industrial
yep.
pine forest.
Yes.
And I think most deer hunters understand that. You know, they see timber harvests all the time. They see the trucks on the road and everything. You know, they know pine timber is going to be harvested. But when you talk to them about we need to cut some of those hardwood trees down, and then when you specifically start saying, and some of those oak trees need to go as well, that's when we get back to that sacred oak, just like the sacred doe. You know, when you think about it, and I'm going to tie this back to Chris, to something Marcus Lashley found out in his master's degree, is that on the forest that they studied, only about 10% of the oak trees they would classify as excellent producers.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their criteria for an excellent producer is, number one, when they produce a lot of acorns, and then they produce with regularity. So some of those excellent producers, it's every single year that tree is producing a lot of acorns. And then there were a lot of these trees, so we're looking at 90% or maybe 80% are not good producing oak trees. So us as habitat managers and deer biologists, we look at it and we say, what good is that particular oak tree doing me? If it's not producing a lot of acorns every year, then the canopy of that tree is just simply intercepting sunlight that could be striking the forest floor and producing plants that deer could eat. So there really is an optimal way to manage pine trees and hardwood trees where you can have the best. And, you know, something that Marcus found that was really, really cool is that he removed on his forest that he manages, he removed most of the hardwoods and actually increased acorn production. And someone may say, now how in the world is that possible? How could you remove 50% or 70% of the hardwood trees and improve acorn production? Well, the answer is that he left all of the excellent producing trees, and then when all the competition was taken out, those excellent producing trees grew better, their canopy developed even more, and when the canopy developed more, they're producing more acorns.
Exactly.
So, what a win-win. I increased acorn production, and now my landscape has sunlight hitting the ground. And so now he's got cover, he's got herbaceous plants, he's got food, and, you know, that's the way to do it, like you said, if you have the opportunity to manage the habitat.
And by far, I'm not selling pine habitat short either with regards to deer management. You can grow some really nice deer, you know, within pine stands if you're able to manage the understory like you're talking about.
Yeah.
You got to be able to employ prescribed fire within those timber stands. If not, it's just going to eventually grow up into other trees, and especially if you're looking at pine trees, you're going to turn into a sweet gum midstory that's going to shade out everything from a food perspective. So you got to employ fire, you've got to employ herbicides, and on some stands, you're going to be looking at some invasives, either invasive tree species or invasive plant species. So there's really, within a pine stand, you've got more management options from a habitat standpoint than you do with hardwoods.
You really do. It's a lot easier in pine stands.
Yeah, you cut that hardwood tree down, you got to wait 20 to 40 years to see what you're going to do next. It's a whole lot easier to control or manage the plant community within a pine stand than it is hardwoods, in my opinion.
Yeah. I agree. Now, Marcus would fire back at you, Chris, and say, but you can also create a whole bunch of stump sprouts, too, cutting those hardwoods down. So, that tree, it may be 40 years before it produces an acorn, but, man, you're producing a whole bunch of stump sprouts when you do that.
Yeah, and my response to Lashley would be, okay, I'll give you that one, but in return, I've got to manage the people, too. So the people are more prone to manage the pine stands than they are the hardwoods.
Yep, so that's exactly right.
You got to throw the people factor into it as well. So it depends on, you know, the people that you're working with and what their management goals are.
Yeah,
but yes, Marcus is correct. I'm not going to dispute that.
Every place is different, isn't it, Chris?
Correct.
But the composition of people and ultimately the goal line, you know, what they want and how they get there, it's never a cookie-cutter recipe. Every single property, because of the people and because of the land and the habitat, et cetera, every prescription is different.
Yeah, I think I say this daily. Deer management and habitat management, I can do that. We all can do that. But being able to manage people, you almost have to be a psychiatrist if you're going to be a deer biologist.
Yeah,
you've got to be able to work with the people, and it's a challenge.
I could maybe help you out with that, Chris. You know, I got the bald thing going. You could set me up as like Dr. Phil or something like that for your clubs.
Hey, I'm joining you. I'm losing my hair too, so I'll put the tag team.
Okay, Chris. So now let's look at the reverse. We kind of talked about the recipe for success, and I'll summarize. It really means the composition of people. Are they all working towards the same goal? Are they cooperating? And then ultimately, for ultimate success, managing the habitat.
Yeah. Now, if you're looking to optimize the property, you've got to have a good group of people and be able to have control to manipulate that habitat.
So is just the opposite. If we were to look back at, you know, the dozens upon dozens and dozens over the years of clubs you worked with, where either in the clubs, either in their estimation or your estimation, they were not meeting their goals, they were unsuccessful. Would you relate it back to those two things? Would you say, hey, they can't control the habitat, and man, this club, there's 10 different members of this club, and they have 10 different opinions about where they want to go and how they get there. So if we were to summarize those top two or three reasons clubs have been met with success, what are some top two or three reasons why some of them fail?
Number one is, if let's just take a hunting club, for instance. You know, if you've got half the membership of that club, it's just, for example, say, okay, our management goal from a buck standpoint is if we want to manage for mature deer, just say we want to manage for, you know, 5.5 or older bucks. And the other side says, I don't care about age. You know, if a nice 2 or 3 year old buck walks by me, I want to harvest that deer. Well, if, you know, one side's trying to protect and the other side's shooting them, you know, they're not going to reach maturity if they're dead.
Yep.
So, you know, just,
they're not born big. It takes many, many years for them to get big.
You know, of course, you see, you know, just as good, you've seen it just like I have, if on some of these, you know, what I call the higher end properties, that they're in a fantastic location. You know, they're able to produce some really good deer. Of course, everybody out there wants to kill a big deer. I want to kill that Boone and Crockett deer. A lot of these properties, we tell them, you're harvesting Boone and Crockett deer. But they're 130 inches at 3.5 years of age when you kill them.
Yep, so, you harvested them at least two years too soon. Exactly.
Yes. So if, you know, half the membership wants to get that deer to 5, and the other half the membership's going to harvest that animal, there's going to be some conflict within that hunting club.
Yeah.
And I've seen that. I had one property that they made a decision, okay, if we're going to manage, we want to get some age structure back in the buck herd, we're going to shoot for 5.5 years old deer. Rocking along, you know, they gave me a good 4 to 5 solid years. They were harvesting some really good deer. And, you know, I think they got some new members in that didn't quite see see it the same as others, and they reverted. And they're mm-hmm. right back where they started before I started working with them. So if you can't manage the people, it's going to be really hard to manage the deer.
And you know one thing regarding that, Chris, and I got to plug our little book here, is, you know, we talk about that with effective buck management, and that is one thing we see, you know, and you and I have talked about this for years and years and years, and you've seen it firsthand, that it's harvesting the wrong bucks really mm-hmm. gets people in trouble. And it's just because of what you just said. You know, it's, hey, you had the opportunity to harvest 170 class deer, but you shot them 2 or 3 years too soon when they were in the 120s and 130s. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is they see a population of bucks. They're like, well, there's a whole bunch of 2.5 and 3.5 year old bucks out there. But the thing that is lost on most people is that when you look at that age class, let's just say, in this particular year, all the 3.5 year old bucks, only about, and depending on where you're at, only about 15% of those bucks are going to grow into what we would call, you know, a trophy, the type of buck that you're managing for. And so when you have that one or two or three hunters on your property or club members that are doing as you described, hey, 70% of the hunters are doing the way they should, but this 30% of the hunters, they're killing these really nice bucks at 3.5, they essentially shot them all. They're going to have 3.5-year-old bucks that grow up to be 5, but they don't have the antlers that they're looking for, because they shot that 15%. Sometimes it's 10%, sometimes it's 20%, but those are the ones that we call the future all-stars.
Yeah.
And the all-stars get harvested at 3, and it's mainly because the all-stars are big enough at 3 years of age that the social pressures aren't there when you harvest them. And what I mean by that, Chris, you know, social shame when you come back and everybody looks at you and, what did you shoot that? But if you harvest a buck that's scoring in the 130s, most of the time there's not going to be any social shame with that. Hey, that's a nice buck. It's a 130 class buck. Then you get with a biologist or somebody and they extract the mandible and go, oh, boy, that was 3.5. 3.5-year-old buck. That was your all-star. There's only a handful of those bucks on every property. And so...
Yeah, and like you said, what you just said, there's only a handful of those deer. And another problem that I've seen in the past is that you've got to have realistic management expectations for that property. You know, if you're down in, just say, Jackson County, Mississippi, it's nothing but, you know, low quality habitat, low quality soil, nothing but pines and sand and yopine. If your goal is to consistently grow mature large bucks, that's not realistic. So the first thing, the people have to have realistic management expectations. Can we grow that deer that you're talking about? Some properties can't.
Yeah.
And if you're not realistic, you know, I can't produce for you as a biologist.
Chris, can I be a nerdy academic for just a moment and
sure.
And potentially modify what you said? You know, I've been working a lot with Craig Harper the last couple years on the interaction of soils and plants and deer nutrition. And the modification I would make is that, as you said, in Jackson County or somewhere similar, a situation like that, they could manage the habitat better and get better results and produce more plants. The issue is you can't do it as efficiently. Does that make sense? You're in a system that would not be as productive. And so you can still manage for sunlight, putting it on the ground, using prescribed fire, and have those plants on the landscape. And deer will, of course, respond and increase in size. But it's almost like a numbers game now. I could do the exact same habitat management prescription, let's say, in a soil in your neck of the woods, and let's say in units of 10, and I get 10 units for my effort, my return on investment. Down in that other part of the Mississippi, I may only get 2 units of return on investment, and that's because of what you just described. It's the soil is not as productive. It doesn't grow the density of plants, the size of plants. So, and I guess I say that, Chris, I don't want to discourage anyone from habitat management based on where they're at. Most everybody can improve what they have. But in certain parts of Mississippi and certain parts of the country, you're just going to get a greater return on your habitat management investment. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree. I mean, anybody in Mississippi, any property in Mississippi, you can manage habitat on that property. You just got to understand what that habitat is able to produce from a wildlife perspective. You know, I can go in South Mississippi, just like you're talking about, I can have a really good timber program. I can have a really good prescribed burning program, you know, using herbicides when needed. I can get that habitat perfect for that neck of the woods. But, you know, if your goal is to produce, you know, 140 to 150 inch deer annually, that system may not do that for you just because of location. Yep. But you may be able to produce some really healthy deer at, you know, it may be more realistic that you can produce 125 to 130 inch deer annually. That's 4 to 5 years of age, and still be a really healthy deer herd. It's just, you've got to realize at what level can that habitat produce, just like you said.
Yeah.
You've got to be realistic for the location.
And but hey,
I don't want to discourage anybody from managing habitat on their property.
Yeah. And let's go back. Let's go back to our research. And I say our research because you played a big role in it. In fact, when I'm giving presentations, I've got a picture of you standing over a deer that you had darted that was part of the MSU MDWFMP genetics environment study that we've had a few podcasts about. You know, when we were able to take those deer from what we call here in Mississippi the lower coastal plain, which we kind of call our sandy soil area that Chris is referring to, you know, when we got those deer and they were given a really nutritious diet, they responded. And they grew just as big. But it took a while, and it actually took two generations.
Mm-hmm.
That was when we talked about that epigenetic effect, and, you know, we really needed to get mother in good condition. And when mother was in good condition, mother had better fawns. You know, those genes for bigger bodies and genes for bigger antlers were more or less the switch was flipped on. So we've proven, Chris, together, you know, and all of our colleagues, that those deer that come from those counties that we associate as poor quality, it's still a nutrition factor. It's not genetics. But your point is not lost, and I completely agree on the efficiency of it. And some places are just more productive. You can produce more deer. You can produce more deer forage per acre of land than you can in some other places.
Exactly. Yeah, all of that research was, I'm really happy to have played a role in that research. It was a lot of long days and long nights, but it made me a better deer biologist doing so. But it was funny that those lower coastal plain deer actually caught up with the Delta deer just because we changed the nutrition. I don't think we were expecting that level of a jump from those deer, but they did it.
Well, if you remember from one generation to two, I mean, we went from bewilderment straight to bewilderment. If that first generation, those lower coastal plain deer didn't budge, we say, how in the world can this be? They've been eating their entire life after they were weaned as buck fawns. I mean, as soon as they were weaned, they ate the exact same diet as those deer that came from the Delta, and their antlers were a little bit larger, you know, not really significantly, and their body weight improved on average by 1 pound.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is this possible? But it took mother, you know, and then that second generation, when mother was able to grow up on really, really good nutrition, that's when we saw that huge jump. You know, that's when we saw, you know, 30-pound increase in body weight. And similar improvement in antlers. And so I guess I want to say that as well. When in certain places, when you start with habitat, increasing food plots, increasing habitat management prescriptions like Chris you're talking about, it still takes time. It's not going to be we're going to see things turn around next year. It may be 5 years down the road before you really start seeing improvement.
Definitely. And that just leads to another situation. You know, looking at that study, you know, some people say, well, Mississippi has a genetics problem. So, you know, we need to go up north or out to Texas, or, you know, where the deer are better or they're bigger or whatnot. Mississippi, that that study showed that Mississippi does not have a genetics problem. I've got some property that I'll put up with anybody out west from a, you know, a quality deer herd standpoint and antler size. But in some places, we have a nutrition problem, i.e. Yeah. habitat. And just like you said, location may not be as productive as some other locations in the state, but if we can get a little age on these deer, get the right nutrition to them, I think what Mississippi's been in the top 10 from a deer state perspective the last few years nationally.
Yeah, so, they certainly have.
I mean, we've got a tremendous resource here in Mississippi. I mean, every deer hunter in Mississippi should be very proud of what this state has.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, I'm a Boone and Crockett scorer. So one thing I keep up with a lot of the Boone and Crockett stats. And so, you know, Chris, of course, that's the very, very, very top end. Typical. That's a buck netting 170. But within the southeastern states, Mississippi has led in the past decade of harvesting more Boone and Crockett bucks in Mississippi than any other southeastern state, and I attribute it to management and education. I think your former agency, MDWFMP, and Mississippi State and the Deer Lab and Extension all working together, I think we have really educated people about nutrition and letting bucks age, because that's what it takes. Good nutrition, and it needs to be 4, 5, 6 years of age, and you do that on enough property and enough times, and you start harvesting Boone and Crocketts.
And I guess, Bronson, this is going to start showing the age, our age to us. You know, been in the game, professionally, almost 20 years? I hate to say that.
I hate to acknowledge that you're right, yeah.
But, you know, think about it back then when we started as graduate students and kind of got out in the real world after that, how the management mentality in Mississippi has changed.
Yeah.
And that's a product of what you just said, the efforts of the State Wildlife Agency, MDWFP, Mississippi State University, you know, some other professionals out there. You know, it's a testimony to what the leaders in deer management have done in Mississippi. It's, I don't think you can beat it.
That's right. Knowledge is power, and we've been trying to help people with that.
And I'll give a corny plug to Steve Damaris, who he was my advisor, along with when you were there. We served as grad students under him.
And we lived through it.
Barely, but we did. Between him and, you know, Harry Jacobson, what he did to get things started in Mississippi, and all the, I guess, what I'll call, quote-unquote, all the old biologists at MDWFP, the Larry Castles of the world, the Donnie Lewis's, the Bobby Wilson's, that cohort. You know, I can't imagine what they went through. It had been so cool to work through that era when, you know, they wanted to shoot the biologists just because they told them, you know, you need to harvest a few does annually, compared to what we're doing now that in some places you can't harvest enough deer. It's a lot, it's a tremendous amount of history in Mississippi when it comes to deer management.
You're exactly right. Man, so much has changed in the last 20 and 30 years. Yep. It's a lot to be proud of, isn't it?
Yep, it is. I'm glad to see what we've done in Mississippi with our deer population.
Well, Chris, I have kept you for a good while here.
Personally, I could probably talk another hour, but I know we've got other things we need to do.
Yeah, it's that darn thing called work.
Yeah,
that appointments and conference calls and all that stuff we've got to get back to. Any closing thoughts or anything you might want to tell the listeners if somebody wanted to contact you and bend your ear about deer or deer management?
Yeah, the main thing is, I mean, we've talked about, you know, growing deer and, you know, harvesting this Boone and Crockett deer or whatnot. It's not all about the size of the antlers. The main important thing is to have fun. Get your kids out there. Get your family out there just go be in the woods. If you get to a point where it's not too much, it's not fun, it's too much peer pressure, and we've taken it too far. You know,
yep.
Everybody has, you know, different management goals compared to, you know, I just want to go out there, and if I see a couple deer per hunt, I'm ecstatic.
Yeah.
Compared to on the other end, you know, I may want to manage for a mature deer herd. So main thing, just keep it fun. And
I couldn't agree more.
And if anybody's got any questions, they can feel free to contact me. My cell phone number is 601-757-2313. And my email address is cmcdonald@thetimberlandagency.com.
But if they just plug that in Google, Chris, would it pop up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Thetimberlandagency.com is our website.
All right.
And I can talk deer with anybody, so I love it. So.
Yes, you can. So can I. Okay, buddy, it was great. Great talking to you. Appreciate you spending some time. I thought it would be real valuable for everybody to hear it from you. You are out there doing it, putting it on the ground. And so I hope that helps a lot of people in terms of things you have seen over the years that made for success and that made for, unfortunately, made for failure. So thanks again, Chris, for your time.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity, and just hope everybody has a good hunting season, and just be careful out there in the woods.
Okay, buddy. Talk to you soon, Chris. Thank you.
All right, take care.
We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.